Hello, I'm Keith Parent, and welcome to Focus Asia Pacific from PCJ Radio International. Indonesia's decision to pause the execution of death row prisoners while its economy is in the doldrums has been welcomed by Australia's immigration minister. Confirmation of a stay on executions comes as a senior Indonesian cabinet minister says the difficult relationship with Australia is rapidly improving. Indonesia correspondent Adam Harvey filed this report from Jakarta.
Resentment towards Australia over spying scandals and trade disputes is fading in Jakarta. And 6 months after the killing of Andrew Chan and Myuran Sukumaran, there has been a genuine patching over of the two nations' fractious relationship. Senior Indonesian cabinet member Luhut Panjaitan was in Australia earlier this week for counter-terrorism talks. Upon his return to Jakarta, he said he even spoke with Australian cabinet ministers about the hugely controversial topic of Indonesia's death penalty. It was fruitful and warm, and this was the first time it happened for a while. Our relationship was on a low level, and our ambassador told me this was the first time we both talked about the death penalty, which has become a sensitive issue in Australia. Luhut confirmed yesterday that he'd told Australia that executions have been stopped for now. There are 138 people on death row in Indonesia, including 57 people convicted of drug offences. Luhut linked the decision to put a stay on executions to Indonesia's flagging economy. I told them we do not yet execute the death penalty as long as our economy is still in its present condition. We are still concentrating on our economy, and they understand this. Indonesia's once booming economy has been struggling this year, with lower growth and higher unemployment setting in. Joko Widodo's government has tried to stop the rot with an unprecedented 6 stimulus packages. Australia's Immigration Minister Peter Dutton was in Jakarta yesterday to announce new visa rules to make it easier for Indonesians to work in Australia. He was asked about the stay on executions.
Well, obviously, the Australian government's position is well known in relation to that matter, so we welcome the announcement, but I wouldn't have anything further to add than that.
Indonesia's Luhut Panjaitan said for the sake of harmony, the two countries would keep future controversies behind closed doors. We also agreed that in the future, President Jokowi and Prime Minister Turnbull will do regular phone conversations so their personal relationship would strengthen. Thus, the relationship between the two countries would also improve. And more than that, if problems between the two countries arose, they are to be resolved without involving publication that would cause such an uproar as had happened in the past. Reflecting the improving relationship, a group of Australian ministers are due to return to Jakarta shortly before Christmas to meet President Joko Widodo.
In Myanmar, the death of 97 mine workers in a landslide at a jade mine on the weekend has exposed the deadly risks of the unregulated industry. A report into Myanmar's jade industry also warns that it could provide a war chest for the military, with the potential to destabilize the country's move towards democracy. South Asia correspondent Liam Cochrane reports.
In the early hours of Saturday morning, tons of rubble dumped from a nearby jade mine gave way, causing a landslide that buried people as they slept. Recovery efforts continue, but there's little hope of finding anyone still alive. The town of Pekan in Myanmar's Kachin state produces some of the highest quality jade in the world, mostly for the Chinese market. But the area is off-limits to foreigners and run by powerful companies with alleged links to the military and ruling party. Mike Davis is a senior advisor with the London-based group Global Witness, which last month released a report on Myanmar's jade trade. He says life for the miners, like those caught in the landslide, is bleak.
The conditions are, in a word, dystopian, because these are people who are trying to scratch a living in what now resembles a moonscape, because the landscape there has been totally obliterated by the industrial-scale mining operations of the large companies. And a common observation by people who live there is that day by day, the valleys are turned into mountains, the mountains are turned into valleys. And what they're talking about is the fact that hills there are literally cut in half or obliterated completely in the company's ravenous hunt for jade. And of course, when they do that, they then have to put the waste somewhere, and they very often tip it into rivers or into lakes, or they build it up into huge tailings dumps like the one which appears to be the case, the one that collapsed.
And how common are landslides in this area?
They are extremely common. I mean, we don't know the full extent of them, but we know of several incidents this year in which several people at a time have been killed. For instance, there was one in January, a tailings dump, which was used by three of the big companies, collapsed, killed several people. Another tailings dump in another area collapsed in March and again in April, killing dozens of people. In April, there was a huge accident, which, unlike this one, mostly affected people who were actually working for one of the big mines, in which up to 60 people were killed. And this was a mine which is run by the family of the recently deposed military party, the USDP General Secretary, a man called Ma Mon Thein. His family controls that company.
Global Witness estimates that Myanmar's jade trade was worth $31 billion in 2014. That's about half the entire gross domestic product of the country. But Mike Davis says very little of that money goes into developing Myanmar.
So it's a transformative sum of money, and in a way that's the point, because on the one hand, this is money which should be used for development for people who very much need it. But equally, it's money which doesn't evaporate. It goes into the hands of the wrong people. And so, in fact, what it's doing is it's empowering some of the most dangerous opponents of peace and democracy in Myanmar. And that's something which people should take very seriously indeed, because as we've seen through the elections, the military hardliners have no popular support. They've been given the boot by the voters. But, I mean, if these same people are allowed continued access to what amounts to a war chest, they remain potentially in the game and potentially, you know, a source of significant trouble down the line. If they choose to be disruptive, they would need the finances to do that. Insofar as some of the key players have a very dominant role in the jade business, they may still have that opportunity. And that's why the new government really needs to prioritising, prising the grip of these people away from the jade business.
The deadly terrorist attacks in Paris have served as a chilling demonstration of Islamic State's global reach. And in the latest edition of its online magazine, the BIC, the extremist group, is urging its Australian supporters to carry out similar attacks. The magazine eulogizes Farid Jabbar, the 15-year-old who last month shot dead accountant Curtis Chung outside police headquarters in Parramatta. Radicalization experts say there's an increased communication between the group and Australian sympathizers since the Paris attack. Michael Edwards has this report.
Social media has proved to be a devastatingly effective tool for Islamic State to attract supporters and assist in their radicalisation. And in the wake of the Paris attacks, those monitoring extremist activity online have noticed a sharp increase in chatter. Dr. Robin Torok is an expert in online radicalisation at Edith Cowan University.
Post-Paris, they've certainly been upscaling their process in regards to recruitment for attacks.
One way IS spreads its message is through its online magazine, Dabiq. The 12th edition is now available, and Dr. Torok says it focuses on what is described as just terror.
It's specifically relating to young people, and it's talking about exacting revenge. It's looking at just punishment, so looking at what happened with the plane with Russia and also what happened with the attacks in France is due to crimes against Islam. It's against mockery of the Prophet. It's against airstrikes.
The latest Dabiq also features Farhad Jabbar, the 15-year-old who shot dead police civilian employee Curtis Chang in Parramatta. It describes him as a brave knight and claims the killing was done on behalf of Islamic State.
Now, they're using him as an example, particularly in Australia, calling for more attacks in the West, particularly Australia. They're saying if you plead allegiance locally to al-Baghdadi and to the Khalifa, then you have the green light, basically, to act on behalf of the Ummah.
It's estimated there are around 400 people in Australia on terrorism watch lists. Many have sympathies with Islamic State. Former intelligence analyst David Wells says it would be difficult for IS to plan an attack in Australia on the scale of Paris.
I mean, certainly there's interest in Australia within IS and the propaganda arm, but it's difficult to say what interest there would be at the operational sort of senior level in targeting Australia, given, relatively speaking, how difficult that might be.
David Wells believes the biggest concern for Australia remains so-called lone wolf attacks. Stopping these is a huge task for security agencies.
From my own research just on social media, there's a huge amount of material out there that is potentially of extremist nature, but I think what authorities will be really keen to do is to differentiate between people who are, perhaps have sympathies with the ideology and, I guess, people who are sufficiently radicalised to pose an operational threat. And I think that's always the challenge.
And you're listening to Focus Asia Pacific, coming to you from PCJ Radio International. Well, recently was the anniversary of German unification. Now, there's two other countries that people have been discussing unification for a number of years, and that is North and South Korea. However, unlike East and West Germany, North and South Korea are very much very well apart. BBC reporter Steve Evans has a look at how the two countries are further apart than the GDR and FDR.
There is now a bit of the Berlin Wall in the middle of the South Korean capital. A concrete section of three slabs stands outside one of the museums as part of an exhibition comparing divided Korea with divided Germany. School kids gaze attentively. They touch the rough concrete and take selfies in front of it. They are entranced by it. As they would be. If reunification could happen in Germany, why not in Korea, is the question hanging over them and their country. Under the South Korean constitution, the five provinces of North Korea, when the peninsula was last united 70 years ago, remain part of the United Korea, which South Korea continues to pretend to administer. I say pretend because there is in Seoul a whole building full of civil servants who technically oversee North Korea. There are departments there for each of those provinces. Except that they can't administer it from Seoul because it's in North Korea. There is the small matter of the inaptly named demilitarized zone in the way, Korea's version of the Berlin Wall. I went to visit the ministry the other day, and it has to be said that the southern administrators of North Korea do not seem to be overburdened. There seemed to be a bit of online shopping occurring on some of the computer screens. Research into the online market for frocks, it seemed to be. But who can blame them? The imminent collapse of the North Korean regime has been predicted since 1990, and today it seems no nearer. The shadow government is in a gloomy building, with a staff of 44 people, preparing for something not likely to happen soon, and perhaps not ever. The corridors are long and empty and quiet. I met one of North Korea's putative rulers, who told me that one of their main roles is to keep North Korean culture alive until the great day of reunification comes. That means organizing folk dancing displays in the South. On their way into work, these theoretical administrators of North Korea pass a light blue postbox by the main entrance. On it is written, in English, Homesickness Postbox. This is for people from the North living in the South to post letters home, except that the letters will never get there because there's no postal service between the two Koreas. The postbox is a gesture, the administrator told me. So is the ministry, if you ask me. There was a time back in the 50s and 60s when the department was seen as a real government in exile, ready to take over. Nowadays, it is not. The bureaucrats there do not imagine that they will soon be sitting in similar seats in Pyongyang, running the place instead of Kim Jong-un. They do not. The talk in the South these days is not so much about the imminence of the collapse of the North, but more about the consequences, whenever, if ever, it happens. The exhibition in Seoul, with a chunk of the Berlin Wall, makes clear how different the Korean and the German situations are. There are charts showing how, even during the last years of divided Germany, 6 million people were reunited with their families from the other side of the wall. In Korea, in the last 14 years, the number has been less than 2,000. People in North Korea have virtually no contact with outsiders. All of East Germany, apart from the most eastern part around Dresden, could watch West German TV every night. They saw the outside world. North Koreans do not. Incomes in South Korea are 10 to 20 times higher than they are in North Korea, and that's a much, much bigger gap than that between East and West Germany. That means that if reunification happened, the economic jolt would be much greater. Already, North Koreans who defect find that their skills aren't adequate for South Korea. doctors who defect from the North often fail to pass standard South Korean medical exams. This all indicates that the immense effort and money required for Korean reunification would dwarf the scale of the task in Germany. But the bureaucrats in the shadow ministry in Seoul have some time yet to ponder the problem. Kim Jong-un does not fear their imminent arrival to take his job in Pyongyang. In the meantime, there is much to do, like a spot of online shopping and organising folk dances.
Now to Fiji, where the opposition whip has accused the country's finance minister of making racist gestures towards him during a heated exchange in Parliament. Last Wednesday, Ratu Asoya Tikaka accused the minister of corruption, claiming he had proof of it in documents that he tabled last Friday. He said Mr. Saeed Karam then imitated his voice, made grunting noises, and raised his arms in an ape-like gesture towards him.
He's making accusation of corruption. Do you have any proof?
I have a lawyer.
Oh, then present it! Then present it, my friend! You don't have a leg to stand on.
Bring yourself down.
Oh, yes! Oh! Oh!
Oh! Ratu Asoya Tekotaka told Jamie Tawanawa that, in his view, the comments were definitely not lighthearted.
It came about when they purposely declined our request to send permanent secretary to answer to very important issues that is coming out from the budget under the various ministries. So I raised that, and during that we ended up in few exchanges. And in the process, he had actually imitated my voice, and it was quite insultive the way he does it, and like he is actually referring that we indigenous Fijians, Itoke people, that we are gorillas or monkeys, whatever he's trying to implicate.
Can we just clarify what he was doing? So he was imitating your voice while gesturing in an ape-like manner.
Like a monkey or like a gorilla. It's up to you. When you look at the action that he does, it probably covers that both whether it's a monkey or gorilla. And to us, it's an insult to indigenous people, and that's probably what he does.
How was that one gesture? How can you interpret that as being aimed at towards all Itaoke?
Well, my voice, as you probably heard, is a deep voice. And it looks at us as the way he actually interprets things. He looks at us on a different line altogether. And that's why I'm saying that he is actually inferring or referring to us that we are that type, probably a gorilla or probably a monkey in the way that he's acting that. And to us, that is an insult.
Mr. Saeed Kayyum released a statement last night saying that he was mimicking Darth Vader speaking and not acting in an ape-like manner. Through that, he also accuses the opposition of trying to interpret his light-hearted Darth Vader impression as a racist gesture. What do you make of that statement?
You know, what comes out of you is the reflection of what is inside. You can hide it as much as you can, but once you are pushed in the corner, you can't control yourself. Your inner being is revealed. It's just a load of rubbish he's trying to actually justify. But do you see his action? Oh, come on. It took me 3 days waiting for him to apologize. And after 3 days, he doesn't want to apologize.
In Parliament, you did ask Jiko Leveni to force Ms. Saeed Kayyum to apologize. That didn't happen. She overruled that request, didn't she?
Yeah. Yeah, he said that it's unbecoming. I should have raised it there and then. But we were in a committee of surprise, so I took that opportunity. Two things. One, 3 days for that guy to apologize. Secondly, and if this is not, I will then raise it up when Parliament proper proceedings begin.
So Friday, yesterday's Parliament session, was the first opportunity you had to...
Yes. I know my standing orders. I cannot raise it there any earlier than that.
The Australian government is reviewing laws that allow states and territories to sell strategic assets to foreign companies without federal review. It follows a controversial decision by the Northern Territory government to allow a state-owned Chinese company with military links to lease the port of Darwin for 99 years. The Prime Minister, Malcolm Turnbull, says he's satisfied there is no national security concerns, despite receiving a rebuck from the U.S. President Barack Obama, who learned about the lease through the media. Now, momentum for building a Senate inquiry into the decision is gaining momentum. Next, Elizabeth Jackson speaks to Stephen Conroy, a shadow defense minister. She asked him, do you think the Americans have the right to feel aggrieved?
Well, I think they certainly have a right to be surprised that they weren't informed at all. It's quite an extraordinary failure of process, which goes along with the actual shambles of the decision-making process here in Australia. So you've got a failed process of assessment here in Australia, and you've got a failure to inform our ally who have genuine concerns about this decision.
Well, how damaging then has it been, do you think, to our relationship with the US?
I think it's just embarrassing for Scott Morrison, embarrassing for Prime Minister Turnbull. I mean, this is a decision that completely came out of left field for the Americans. It came out of left field for many Australians. I listened earlier this morning to the Northern Territory minister, who was quite frankly astonishing, had not done due diligence, didn't know about the links with the PLA. I mean, these are basic questions that should have been asked. They're basic questions that Scott Morrison should have been on top of. They're basic questions that all Australians want an answer to.
But the Prime Minister says that he's satisfied any national security concerns were fully dealt with by the security agencies and the Defence Department before the lease was approved. The Defence Secretary, Dennis Richardson, says he doesn't have any concerns. What are the security concerns from your point of view?
Well, the issue is no one involved in the process appears to have done the basic research to establish whether or not it's true that the very, very strong links between Landbridge and the PLA. I mean, there seems to have been a complete failure of process. And Australians should be concerned that a government that, in these particularly challenging times, have bungled a national security issue like this.
Should states and territories be able to sell strategic assets like this to foreign companies without federal oversight?
Absolutely not. I mean, I'm very concerned about the next major infrastructure asset which has strategic value, which is the Transgrid network in New South Wales, which has a fibre optic network included in its assets, which services defence bases and defence data centres. I mean, these are highly sensitive pieces of national strategic infrastructure. And the proper checks, the proper processes must be in place. We cannot afford to have a bungled process just because a state government wants to take the highest bidder without taking into account national security issues.
So you think deals like this should go before the Foreign Investment Review Board first?
Well, I think there should be a proper process, and we should not have a situation where the information comes to light via the private sector saying, did you know this? I mean, no one is able to reassure Australians that the proper national interest information was available.
Nick Xenophon has flagged a Senate inquiry. You've said Labor supports an inquiry. What do you hope would come of that?
Well, we want to establish the facts. We want to establish who was doing the due diligence on the company, who was able to assess the lengths and depths of the links between companies that are state-owned, intermingled under the Chinese system with private companies, what the extent of that process is. I mean, I was in a situation when we were building the national broadband network where we had to make a decision that essentially Huawei could not bid for key parts of the infrastructure because it was too nationally sensitive. So decisions like this are normal. Decisions like this should be done properly. And what we've seen here is a complete and utter bungling by Scott Morrison, by Malcolm Turnbull, and the defence community behind the scenes are up in arms. The American president has actually raised it publicly. I mean, these show a serious failure in process and in consultation with our allies.
Senator, if we could just turn our attention to Syria briefly. Bill Shorten has described the Syrian President Bashar al-Assad as a butcher. Malcolm Turnbull has called him a murderous tyrant. Does he need to be involved if there's going to be a political solution reached in Syria? I mean, should he get a spot at the negotiating table?
Well, I think if we're going to get a political solution, the discussions are going to obviously involve compromise by all concerned. The ultimate objective should be the removal of a person who has been involved in some heinous acts against his own people. He's still doing it over the last 6 months. So what we want to see is a Syria in a managed process over time with new leadership. And then the focus can be on tackling the Islamic State extremists, and we can then try and get a resolution in Syria for the Syrian people.
But is a political solution viable, or do we need boots on the ground? And if so, whose boots?
Well, I think both the American president and the prime minister, Turnbull, have said that there won't be our boots on the ground. We need local boots on the ground, and I would support that.
Senator, just briefly to the South China Sea, the US President Barack Obama has urged the Chinese to stop any further reclamation and construction in the sea. He's endorsed a process of arbitration to settle differences between China and the neighbouring countries. Is that a viable option in your view?
Well, it's the option that should be pursued by all of the countries. I mean, China, obviously the single largest by a significant magnitude in terms of reclaiming land, but all of the countries should cease their activities. They should all submit to the normal international processes. Unfortunately, China has said it isn't interested in submitting to the international processes and has constantly frustrated those processes. But yes, what should happen is that all of the countries who've been involved in this, we don't recognise or accept anyone's claims. We believe all of these processes should be negotiated and gone through the normal international processes to resolve these disputes. We do not need to turn this area, which is one of the most important transport hubs in the world, into an area where there is tension. This should be arbitrated through international processes.
Senator, thank you.
Thank you very much.
And with that, we've come to the end of this edition of Focus Asia Pacific from PCJ Radio International. If you'd like to let us know what you think of the program, we'd love to hear from you. Our email address is focus@pcjmedia.com. Once again, focus@pcjmedia.com. On behalf of the whole team, I'm Keith Powell, wishing you well, saying so long, take care. We'll see you again very soon. Bye-bye.